From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan and the Air Force agree on cleaning up PFAS around Oscoda, but one PFAS activist calls that a nothing burger.
The state got played like a cheap fiddle in this thing.
Hundreds of young men stepping forward to say they were assaulted, former teen inmates put into adult prisons.
I was sentenced to 3 years. Not 3 years of rape, not 3 years of sexual harassment, abuse.
Will the new no-fault reform law truly help drivers who pay the highest rates in the nation?
It's not going to make insurance in Detroit affordable, just slightly less unaffordable.
Plus, why you're getting flooded with robocalls.
Oftentimes, with the use of technology, these criminals can reside in completely different countries, so they're kind of outside of the reach of the U.S. jurisdiction.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The state of Michigan has reportedly struck a deal with the U.S. Air Force. The deal is meant to speed the cleanup of PFAS contamination around the former Wurtsmith Air Force Base in Oscoda. But not everyone in Oscoda is impressed, and that includes Anthony Spaniola. The Metro Detroit attorney owns land on Van Etten Lake in Oscoda, and he is with us now. Tony, welcome back. What do you think of this new cleanup agreement?
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And unfortunately, as one of my friends in Oscoda who is familiar with this has said, that it's really false advertising. Unfortunately, it's a little bit like those appliance or used car ads that we see in the newspapers claiming there's a big blowout sale. And then you read the fine print and you realize that it's a big nothing burger. And that's what this is, unfortunately. I've heard it said that this is a milestone. And unfortunately, it's really a milestone in misinformation, continuing delays, and inaction. And it's folks like me and Oscoda are not happy at all.
So this, as the state of Michigan, the Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy shakes hands with the Air Force on this deal, you're not impressed. Take us deeper into what your problems are with it.
Well, first of all, when you break it down, and first of all, it's not really an agreement. It's simply some points that have been listed in a press release. And when you break it down, they say that there's a new agreement in several areas. So first of all, there's no new agreement to do any treatment work at the base. There is an existing treatment facility. It's called the Mission Street facility that was designed to treat prior contamination from non-PFAS chemicals, and it has been improperly discharging untreated PFAS chemicals in that whole process, you know, at the base into Van Etten Creek. The Air Force agreed many, many months ago to change that facility over so that it would stop improperly discharging PFAS chemicals. But that's not new, that's old, and it doesn't do anything to address the PFAS groundwater plumes that are continuously and illegally, I might add, contaminating the Van Etten Lake public beach, state campground, and large youth camp.
What about this announcement of starting a third, that the Air Force has agreed to start a third on-base groundwater treatment system to actually clean up that water coming from the outfall pipe to Van Etten Creek?
That's exactly what I just described.
Okay.
That is, again, the big nothing burger. It's not a new agreement. It's something that's been in place for many, many months. And it is to correct the improper discharge from a treatment facility that already exists. That's why I'm saying it's grossly misleading.
Okay.
What
is really needed to make this area safe, in your view?
What's needed right away, and it's something that the community groups have been demanding all the way back to 2017. What we need is immediate action to clean up the contaminant plumes that are contaminating the public beach, the state campground, and the large youth camp area along Van Etten Lake. That's been the focus of the public health warnings about the toxic foam that's been issued. And that's been, again, the focus of, you know, the imminent and substantial health risks that have been identified. You have a beach, you have kids playing, you have a state campground, you have a youth camp with hundreds of kids that are out there playing in this water and in and around this foam. We need to stop that. And we can't continue to test or promise to consider the possibility of actions at some unspecified point in the future. We need to take action now. And it's important to stress that they've been at this for 9 years. And they have test data coming out of their ears up there. There are something like 400 monitoring points that have been sampled and in some cases resampled. We have plenty of data. And the problem that we have is that the Air Force, because Oscoda Wurtsmith is the very first military base on which contamination like this has been discovered, the Air Force is afraid to take action and refuses to do so because if it does it at Oscoda, it may have to do it elsewhere. Unfortunately, the Air Force's concern is not with public health, but saving money. Not only in Oscoda, but around the country. And we have to deal with this on a day in and day out basis. We've sat here and watched. We've seen year in and year out these kinds of misleading and, you know, really nothing burger kind of statements come out. And we're 9 years into it with still no plan.
Did the state get played?
Yes. I think that's a very good way. As a lawyer, we have sort of the vernacular. The state got played like a cheap fiddle in this thing. It's very frustrating. We have people up there who are working hard to try to bring, you know, immediate action to take place. And our folks in the state just don't seem to get it. They're not our champions. They're not fighting for us. And I think the folks at Eagle, we have a new director who I think is doing a really good job. We have a new governor. I think it's time that there be a very serious review, perhaps an independent review, much like the one that was done in Flint, into what's going on here at Oscoda. Because 9 years, no action, it just doesn't add up.
Tony, you have spent a lot of years enjoying Van Etten Lake. And then over the past several years, you've been fully immersed in this PFAS issue in Oscoda. Do you still enjoy your time at the lake? Or are you spending more of your time thinking about this negative stuff?
I still enjoy my time at the lake. I enjoy particularly the people in the community that I've gotten to know because of what's happened. The lake experience, though, is very different. You have to be very thoughtful and careful about what you do and how you do it. So many of us in Michigan experience that northern Michigan sense of freedom and wonder of being out in the wilderness and being able to, you know, enjoy the beauty of nature. And it's just, you know, it's taken away from when you have to think, well, boy, you know, if I see foam, I better stay away from it. Don't eat the fish. For folks who are hunters, don't eat the venison and don't drink the water out of your well. And it just goes on and on and on. And so, yeah, it's impacted things. It's sad. It's really sad.
PFAS activist and Oscoda property owner Tony Spaniola. I know we'll be checking back with you, Tony. It's always great talking with you.
Thanks, Cindy. Good to talk to you.
We reached out to Eagle, the Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, for a response to the frustration in Oscoda. A spokesman says negotiations are ongoing with the Air Force, and the state remains committed to holding the Air Force accountable for the PFAS cleanup. A little over a month after Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed new auto no-fault legislation into law, there's still confusion about what this law will do. The law had the strong backing of two Detroit leaders, Mayor Mike Duggan and Quicken CEO Dan Gilbert. One question now is, will it actually help people in Detroit, for example, who are paying the highest auto insurance rates in the state and in the nation? Last night, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who represents Detroit's 13th district, she held a town hall to try to explain some of the changes. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton was there. Tracy, tell me what people were hoping to hear.
Well, Cindy, I think a lot of people there were like Miles Church. He was there for answers. What can I expect? Are things going to get better?
Well, I hope it'll reduce the rates. It's not just me. It's my neighbors. They also are paying it. Like my neighbor next door. He's a married man. He's got three kids. One just getting a driver's license. So his insurance is going to right through the roof.
So a lot of worry about these huge insurance bills and a lot of questions. So were there answers?
You know, I think people were a little disappointed. There wasn't a ton of clarity here. Congresswoman Tlaib had a panel of folks there, a University of Michigan professor who's looked at the law, three Democratic members of the state house. Two had voted yes, one had voted no. And there was a whole lot of disagreement about what this law will actually do, whether it was a bad law or a good law. The panel made one thing really clear, and that's that the law only promises to cut part of your auto insurance premium. So when I spoke with Katrina Lewis after the town hall, she got it. And she was not happy. She's paying $400 a month for her insurance, $4,800 a year. She can't afford to put her 24-year-old son on her insurance. So she's still driving him to classes at college. And she was less confident after this town hall that she's going to see any relief.
You're only going to save on PIP. This has nothing to do with your overall rate with which people were complaining about.
PIP, which of course is personal injury protection. Some people call it PIP. So what kind of cuts could people, and especially Detroiters, see? Because we're being told these cuts will range from 10 to 45% lower PIP.
Yeah, it's really hard to estimate because the cuts could end up being average statewide. We don't know how insurance companies are going to change rates in response to the law. You know, we can assume for the sake of argument, let's say if you live in Detroit, you're going to save between 10 and 45% on your PIP. So I live in Ann Arbor, so he asked a coworker, can I see your premium?
She lives in Detroit.
Yeah, she lives in Detroit, and her PIP right now costs her $450 a year. So let's say next year she chooses the lowest coverage amount, $20,000 for an accident, she could see a savings of 45%, or about $200 a year. But she's not going to do that. She has kids, so she wants to have the most coverage she can get. So she's going to choose the highest coverage amount, and that's similar to what we have now. That's unlimited lifetime coverage. That's supposed to get her a 10% cut on PIP. Or $45.
Okay, that is not a lot. Even that $200 decrease is not a lot. And the other parts of her bill wouldn't go down?
Yeah, that's right. And there's even the risk they might go up and extinguish the savings on PIP. At any rate, for this Detroiter, you know, her premium might go from $2,000 a year to $1,950. A lot of Detroiters are paying $4,000 to $5,000 a year. And you know, they may save a few hundred dollars a year, but it's not going to make insurance in Detroit affordable, just slightly less unaffordable.
And when are we going to find out what this new law will do?
You know, so the answer is going to kind of come one insurance policy at a time. Let's say your premium renews in July. You're going to see your new coverage amounts that you can choose. You will see whether you save anything. If your policy renews in October next year, then that's when you're going to see what you might be able to save.
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Coming up, few of us can escape robocalls and phone spam these days. Michigan recently joined other states suing to do something about them. But what can be done exactly? That is after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for Theater Talk as we survey some of the offerings from professional theater companies around the state. David Kiley of Encore Michigan, we're starting out in Chelsea.
Yes. The first play I want to talk about, it's a new work at the Purple Rose Theater. It's called Welcome to Paradise. It's a play about a woman of a certain age, early to mid-70s, played brilliantly by Ruth Crawford, who has been a fixture in Michigan theater for many years. She encounters a young man in his mid-20s on her flight to her home on a Caribbean island. He helps her home after she had kind of a fainting episode or something at the airport, and he winds up staying for a few weeks. This is a play about relationships, the one between these two people who are very different in ages, between Evelyn, Crawford's character, and her adult son, between the adult son and his wife, between Evelyn and her granddaughter, between Evelyn and her daughter-in-law. Mostly, I think this play is about the family we choose in life versus the family we're born to. And I think a lot of people will relate to this as, you know, people who maybe rather have a Friendsgiving with the people that they love rather than go somewhere with all the stress of the extended family. It's to me, that's kind of what it spoke to. It's not a tearjerker. There's no big denouement. It's not a play that's going to beat you up emotionally. It's thought-provoking. And Crawford is fabulous in this role.
So come take an acting class and watch her. Ruth Crawford.
She's wonderful.
That's great. And again, just a hat tip to the Purple Rose for finding interesting material and giving it a space.
You know, next year, 4 original plays at the Purple Rose, all from Michigan playwrights. So
we'll be watching.
How great is that?
Now we head over to Summer Theater, and we are going to start in Coldwater.
Yeah, at the Tibbetts Opera House, they're doing Joseph and His Technicolor Dreamcoat, the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. This is a story based on the Coat of Many Colors story of Joseph from the Book of Genesis. And let's hear a little bit.
And in the east, the dawn was breaking, and the world was waking. Of light, my golden coat flew out of sight. The colors faded into darkness. I was left alone.
And of course, that was Donny Osmond, who owned that role of Joseph in the 1990s on Broadway and on tour around the country. Fun fact, he was in our studio when he was visiting Detroit, and he was reminiscing and telling us what it was like when he first played Joseph. And he said, I went through rehearsal. We went through everything. I was worrying about my lines and blocking and all of that. It comes time for opening night, and he said, it hit me. I'm standing in front of all of these people, and I'm wearing a diaper. He was delicious.
You know, he for being a teen idol, he really grew into the role that he has now of
yes.
being a serious musical theater person. He's very interesting. He's very, you know, he's actually a very, very nice guy. I've never had the pleasure.
He is very, very nice.
But and just another fun fact, which I didn't realize, which is that this is actually the first Lloyd Webber and Rice musical to be performed publicly. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And of course, like most Webber musicals, it's almost entirely sung. There's just a few words. It's a feel good show. Has tunes that you hum afterward while walking in your car. It's
Well, I believe they wrote it for a school project. And a fun fact, let's all feel bad now. Andrew Lloyd Webber was 19 years old when he wrote Joseph. So talk about wrecking the curve for everybody.
Pretty much, yeah.
Now we go to Augusta to the Barn Theater. There's always fun stuff coming out of the Barn Theater.
Yeah, I mean, this is a summer theater that has 8 shows from June till the first week of September.
Ooh.
It's astonishing. And they very good, high quality. This week that they are opening Sweeney Todd, and that plays through July 14th. This is, of course, the Sondheim classic about a really dark mashup between a barbershop and a meat pie shop in London. Let's hear a little bit from the Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
In the street. Mrs. Mooney has a pie shop, does a business, but I've noticed something weird. Lucky all her neighbors' cats have disappeared. I have to hand it to her, what a cool enterprise. Bumping pussies into pies, wouldn't do in my shop. Just a thought of it's enough to make you sick. And I'm telling you, that pussycat is quick. Now denying times is hard, sir. Even harder than the worst pies in London.
And of course, the always fabulous Angela Lansbury in that cast album.
You know, that was the revival with her. And she was not young. And that is an incredibly demanding role. And you can hear, if you listen to that on YouTube, you can hear her really laboring to get that song and some of the other ones done. Sondheim is miserable for people who work at singing.
Intimidating, we shall say. All right, let's head north to Traverse City.
Yes, there's a theater up there called Parallel 45, which performs right downtown. This theater's been around a few years, but its productions have been a bit here and there, if I can say, and a little bit inconsistent. But this summer, they're really breaking out with three strong-looking productions and lots of out-of-town actors. They're doing Hair, the musical, which, of course, the 60s kind of love and rebellion story, had a really long run on Broadway and then made to a film. It's been reinterpreted a bit since then by a lot of theaters. So I'm interested to see what they do with it. And it opens on July 11th, on my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Then a play called Little Bunny Foo Foo.
Okay.
And it opens on July 18th. The title suggests this is a play for the young folks. And then they're doing a play called, let's see if I can do this right for the NPR audience, Stupid Effing Bird. Is that okay?
Got it.
Okay. Stupid Effing Bird by Aaron Posner, which is based on Chekhov's The Seagull. This is not for the young folks. It's also a play that just seems to be, it's being done everywhere. Like every time we turn around, another theater is doing this show. That and Mamma Mia. So I, you know. So as is the case with a lot of summer theaters, the first one opens on July 11th, and then they'll open kind of a week apart. And then the first week of August, they kind of overlap. So if you're in Traverse City that week, and it rains,
you got a twofer.
you can see maybe all three,
You
know, that same week. So,
well, very fun. Lot of choices all around Michigan. And, of course, for details on these and other productions, just head right over to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, thanks, and early happy birthday.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. If it seems like the only phone calls you get are robocalls, you have plenty of company.
Press 1 to get a hassle-free assessment, or press 2 to be placed on our Do Not Call list.
您有一封重要文件尚未领取，如有任何疑问，请您
return the call before we begin with the legal proceedings against you. Thank you.
These are just a few of the robocalls I've gotten, and I'm sure you have gotten your fair share as well. Robocall Index tells us in June there were 4.4 billion calls placed in the U.S., a whopping 6 million calls per hour. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel has joined other state attorneys general in working with the FTC, trying to stamp out pre-recorded telemarketing calls with an effort called Operation Call It Quits. Adam Dupe is an assistant professor at Arizona State. He studies cybersecurity, has co-authored a paper on robocalls. Adam, so good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Cindy. I'm very happy to be here.
So I want to be very clear what we're talking about. We hear terms like robocalls. We hear spam calls. Is it the same or are there differences?
So, yeah, these are kind of umbrella terms where the key idea is these are phone calls that people are making through automated means. So they're calling your phone using some phone list that they've gotten, and they're using automated systems to place calls to your cell phone and your landlines. And that's why they're able to do it at such a large scale.
Boy, and that's true. So there may be a person on the other end of that call, or it may be a recording, but it's basically they're using this automated way of getting through to you.
Exactly. So what they can do is when they detect that somebody picks up, they can route you through to a real person, and that way they can call more people. The other thing that they can do is they will wait until you actually interact with the system, so they can have the recording say press 1 to talk to an agent, and as soon as you press 1, then they'll connect you to a real person who will try to probably scam you, depending on the nature of the robocall.
Well, indeed, indeed. So, for instance, my husband got three automated calls yesterday, purportedly from the government, demanding his Social Security number. What are some of the greatest hits? Some of the most common calls and scammy pitches going right now?
Yeah, so there's the two main areas I always like to think about. One is in terms of financial institutions where they're trying to scam your credit card number, because that's something that can be monetized by criminals. They can make a fake credit card with your number and try to use that at various places online and also in person. The second major area is in terms of impersonating the government to try to get your Social Security number. So this could be through IRS scams or just general impersonation of scary governors. The one I'm getting a lot of is not paying student loans that is coming through. So, and really the criminals are trying to get at that information that can be repurposed and sold.
And when we say these criminals, how much do we know about who the people are behind these robocalls, and especially where are they?
That's a great question. And I think the real answer is we don't know. And this is one of the really interesting things about this area, is there hasn't been a lot of research into the ecosystem behind robocalls. So who is actually behind these calls? And oftentimes with the use of technology, these criminals can reside in completely different countries. So they're kind of outside of the reach of the U.S. jurisdiction.
Speaking of crackdowns, I've got to imagine efforts to go after these scammers and these automated calls are complicated, because not all automated calls are bad. I mean, we get them to remind us of snow days at school or doctor's appointments or hair appointments, and that sorting out the good from the bad has to be a real challenge.
Right, exactly. And this is why we kind of face why we're in this situation, is the phone companies. So theoretically, they could take action against robocalls and automated calls and try to block them, but they're known as what's called a common carrier. So they're kind of legally obligated to deliver any phone call that comes to their network and to not discriminate, because of all these reasons that you mentioned. Like, do you really want your notification for your medical appointment to show up as a robocall and get blocked and you'll miss that message? Like, there are legitimate reasons for having automated calls. So it's not necessarily that automation is the problem. It's that people are using these systems for essentially nefarious purposes.
The FTC and state attorneys general, including Michigan's, have committed to cracking down on these robocalls. They've joined the FTC in Operation Call It Quits. What does cracking down on robocalls look like? And as you think of the technology constantly evolving, is it even possible to crack down on them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So really what we try to think about when stopping robocalls, I think there needs to be kind of a multi-pronged approach. And one of the best approaches is to use legislative means, so to increase the penalty. So as of now, the FTC doesn't have very much in terms of the way of teeth as far as going after these criminals. There's only a certain amount of low-level fines they can lay, when really what they're trying to do is increase that so that the penalties can be more steep. Now, then that becomes the problem of how do you go after these people who are outside of the U.S. jurisdiction? And that's where we need kind of technological means to try to combat this problem. And there's a number of technological proposals who are trying to, this is one of the key ways that robocalling can work, is they can spoof the caller ID number that shows up on your phone. So that this way, even if you tried to make a great robocall prevention system, you won't be able to deploy it because you won't actually know where that call is coming from. So how do you know that this actually is a robocall?
Oh, I know what you mean, because when I get the ones that start off like my cell phone with my area code and my first few digits, and I know, and I block them every time, and they keep coming, because you're right, they shift a digit.
Exactly. So these are called neighbor spoofing. And the idea is to trick you to answer the phone. They use a caller ID that's very similar to yours. And I think it's very important, because this is a problem that's really affecting all of us every day. And it's a small, if we're not falling victim to this, we think it's maybe just a small nuisance. But people can fall victim to these scams for hundreds or thousands of dollars. People don't realize necessarily, especially vulnerable populations, that the U.S. government or the IRS is not going to call you directly and demand payment.
Who's most vulnerable to these calls?
Yeah, so what we've seen as far as the FCC reports and the complaints is we've seen a lot, these robocalls target really sensitive demographics. So it's particularly the elderly get targeted and immigrant populations. So even at universities like at ASU, what they'll do is they will call phone numbers around that area because these are students who are here on a student visa. They don't necessarily know that the IRS isn't going to call you and demand money. And they're terrified of losing their visa status. So they'll oftentimes comply with that. Similarly, the elderly population, they kind of grew up in this age where a phone rang and you picked it up, right? It was an important call. So they have this kind of inherent trust in receiving phone calls. So they're more likely to fall victim to these kind of scams.
You know, when you think of what can we do, we as the person holding that that mobile phone, getting the call to protect ourselves. I know I getting myself on the national do not call registry meant nothing because the good companies obey it. The scammers aren't obeying that. What can the average person do in terms of protecting ourselves?
Right. And even worse with the do not call list, not only are the scammers not obeying it, they actually use that list to feed their phone numbers. So they use those phone numbers on that list because for them, what they're trying to do is find real people behind phone numbers. So if you put your name on the do not call list, it means that you are actually at that phone number. So they have a person they can try to scam. So one of the main things to do as a consumer is to protect yourself and to learn and educate yourself and others that a phone call coming in can be spoofed. It could come from anywhere. So if, let's say, your bank is calling you and they're asking for your Social Security number, your credit card number, you should immediately hang up, call them back on their designated 1-800 number on the back of your credit card because that can't be spoofed. So they can't intercept your phone call going to them. You have to be vigilant, not believe what they say, and kind of call them back to verify.
It's been a great talking with you, Adam Dupay, who's an assistant professor at Arizona State University. Thanks for joining us on Stateside.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Cindy. Take care.
Coming up, the Michigan Supreme Court recently cleared the way for hundreds of young men to have their day in court. Young men who say they were assaulted when they were teenagers serving time in adult prisons.
I was sentenced to 3 years, not 3 years of rape, not 3 years of sexual harassment, abuse. It's affected all of us. It's continuing to affect me on the daily.
That is after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hundreds of young men have claimed they were sexually assaulted while serving time in adult prisons when they were teenagers. The state, they say, failed to provide adequate protections. Last month, the Michigan Supreme Court cleared the legal path for them to sue the state of Michigan. We have two of these young men with us today. We're not using their last names because they say they were sexually assaulted when they were minors. Elvir was 15 years old when he was convicted for home invasion and first went into an adult prison.
It's an experience that it's hard to really have somebody capture. Like, the feeling of it is any roller coaster ride, any drop. The thought of it still gets my hands to shake.
Dominique was 14 when he was picked up for armed robbery and 16 when he first went into an adult prison.
My whole life, I was told that I would end up there. So for me, it was just like, all right, now that I'm here, I have to act the part. And in my mind, the part was what I saw on TV.
Dominique and Elvira, along with their attorney, Deb Lavelle, joined me recently to share their experiences and discuss the lawsuit. I began the conversation by asking Elder when these assaults first started. And a warning to listeners, this interview has references to sexual violence.
It started from the gate. There was no pause throughout the whole time. there was no breath. It was rough. It was more than rough. It was something that not too many people can get out of.
Is there a memory that you just cannot get out of your head? Something you can share with us?
I mean, honestly, there isn't a day that there's not a memory. Things that were done to not just me, but almost a lot of the children, the youth in there, it's something that everybody knows of, everybody speaks of, but outside of prison, nobody knows.
So can you give us a sense of what kinds of things you're talking about?
Oh, honestly, it's the day-by-day sexual harassment, whether it's being taken advantage of as a child or it's doing things you don't like to do to somebody else, but you're forced to.
Because what was the or else? Like, you have to do this or else. What was at stake?
See, or else is, it's a way of living because you know that it could be a potential way of dying. I mean, these were life and death situations in there. This wasn't, you have to do this or I'm going to fight you. This was, hey, you could potentially lose your life.
And when you asked corrections officers for help, what happened?
Correctional officers were also part of the problem.
How?
It's, as I said, it's, they like to have the hear no evil, see no evil, but everybody knew it was in plain sight. It's easy to sweep something under the rug if everybody says, oh, it's not a problem. But the issue is it's a serious problem and it's still going on. Things are still happening to children there that everybody just wants to turn a blind eye to.
And Dominique, what about you? When did harassment and assaults begin for you?
I'm definitely going to say immediately, too. I mean, imagine, mind you, when I first became incarcerated, I was 14. First, they sent me to a juvenile correctional facility until I was 16 because I was still in court. And then once I left there, I went immediately to adult prison. So imagine a 16-year-old, basically a 14-year-old, because I haven't been out, going inside a adult male facility where, you know, these men been in here for years upon years. This man in here been lifting weights or, you know, for I don't know how long. So,
and
you know,
I'm going to ask you what I asked Elvira. Give us a sense of what kinds of things we're talking about.
I mean, me personally, I had to endure like gang members trying to rape me, like actually breaking into my prison cell, the cell that I'm supposed to be protected in, you know, by the correctional officers. So they broke into my cell, and quotation marks, obviously, because the correctional officers let them into my cell. You know, so that's how sick it is. And like, imagine you put into a world where everything is going bad and they make it seem as if they make a way to where they can help you per grievances, right? But the thing is, you can write a billion words on them grievances and it don't mean nothing because me personally, I have, and like they've been thrown away. So if I can't voice my problem, if I can't be able to like have no voice at all, say what's going on with me at all, like, and you just throw it away, what can I, you know?
Elvira, I know you want to say something.
It's not just, you know, the prison culture, the prison mentality that goes on there. It doesn't just stay with prisoners. When we speak as correctional officers, somebody who we're supposed to look at as somebody who's supposed to be protecting us, or at least keeping things in order, I mean, I want everybody to be aware that I was sexually assaulted by a correctional officer. I was forced to do things that I had no other choice because, hey, this is who I have to listen to. Now, if you can't run to other prisoners, and I definitely can't run to other correctional officers, what is a boy supposed to do?
It's tough. I can see it in your faces, both of you. Deb LaBelle is their attorney, lead attorney in this class action suit. So, Deb, how many young men, including these two young men, are in this suit?
So, potentially, there are over 1,000, but over 500 have stepped forward and reported rapes. So, these are hundreds and hundreds of youth in age 14 to 17. And I did want to clarify a couple of things. Mm-hmm. youth continue to be put in adult prison, and it's not really the putting them in the adult prison. It's the failure to supervise and provide them protection once they're in there. You know, I understand that the law provides or did provide that if you're, you know, treated as an adult, even whether you're 14 or 15 or 16, and you're put under their care and custody and supervision, the law allows that. But what the law also says is once they're in your care and custody, you cannot subject them to rape and sexual assault and abuse. You have to provide custody, control, and safety. So youth are still going into the adult prisons, and the care and the custody, not just from adult prisoners, but from correctional staff, is a serious problem. And the other thing, and I, you know, that it's a big serious issue in this case, is that either because youth fought to protect themselves or because after they were assaulted, they didn't know what to do with them, many of them spent months and months and months in solitary confinement alone.
Did you?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
After about 2 weeks entering prison due to a fight, I was put into solitary confinement, which is 23-hour lockdown, 5x8 cell.
What is make us understand, where are we right now? What does Michigan law say about putting juveniles in adult prisons?
So it still allows it from the age of 13 on up. I would say within the last year, the department is making attempts that they did not make before to try to separate youth from adults by placing them in one, directly in one area of one facility, okay, which is all good.
Now, the state Supreme Court decision that came down, briefly tell us what was that decision and how does it relate to this class action lawsuit and to formerly incarcerated young men like these two?
So the decision was, these guys have been fighting for, since filing the suit in 2013, so it's been 6 years, to say that they should be protected like anyone else under the Michigan Civil Rights Act, meaning you shouldn't be able to discriminate against them no matter where they're at. So after 6 years, the Michigan courts have said yes, and they've struck down as unconstitutional an amendment to the act that said if you're in detention or jail or prison, you are not protected. Your civil rights are not protected. And so that people could be discriminated against, you know, a black prisoner versus a white prisoner, a woman versus a male. You could be subject to sexual abuse, which is part of our civil rights protections. But the courts have finally said, no, you're persons and you're entitled to the protection of the Civil Rights Act. So now we're going forward with a trial starting in January in Washtenaw County.
Why did it take so long, Deb?
You know, this case by the Attorney General's office has, I have some history with, you know, litigating with the state. I have never seen them fight a case like this one.
Why?
18 interlocutory appeals. We have been up and down. Now, they haven't been successful. You know, they started out saying it wasn't happening, that they were lying, or it was consensual, all of which contributes to a culture inside. If your staff hears you saying, which they continue to say, it doesn't happen. It does not create a culture where staff protect youth, because then if youth come to them and say, this is happening, they say, no, no, it's not. Our boss says it's not happening. And so that is, that very defense has deeply contributed to the harm.
So what are you asking for in this lawsuit, Deb?
So we have two lawsuits, one in federal court and one in state court. In the state court, we're asking for damages for what was done to youth. And what's so significant in this case, most of these youth only had a couple year sentences. And so they're coming out and they're in deep need of treatment. They were harmed inside in a very deep way. And there are no resources for that. So it is, I guess we feel the kind of urgency of the need to get help, to get treatment, to stop people from self-medicating, you know, which will bring you back to prison again, which doesn't do any of us any good. They did wrong. Let's help people.
The state. What's the federal?
In the federal case is both damages, but also in the federal court, we're allowed to ask for changes in relief. Okay. And that is, do not put a child in solitary. If you put a child in a closet for 3 days, the Child Protection Agency would be there. So to put a 14 and 15-year-old for 30, 40, 60 days in an isolation cell, one, it doesn't work. It's just pure cruel punishment and damage. And there are lots of better ways to deal with any issues with youth as opposed to putting them in a hole.
Elvira and Dominique, I'm interested in what this whole process has been like for you as this legal battle that Deb described is playing out over whether you're entitled to civil rights protections as inmates. I mean, what has that been like to be a part of this?
The more people know, the more it's an eye-opener. I know what I feel is right. I know I was sentenced to 3 years. Not 3 years of rape, not 3 years of sexual harassment, abuse, and now who knows how long after my 3 years, it's affected all of us. It's continuing to affect me on the daily.
How?
I mean, it's more of my mental than anything else. Physical, I feel like now I have to be a man to be strong, but emotionally, I'm no different than anybody else. I cry, you know, I have emotions, I feel. I have nightmares. I have panic attacks. You know, it's these things that normal people, you and your fiance, your husband, your wife, you can go to a restaurant, enjoy a nice wine, and have a good time. Me, on the other hand, I can't be inside a room that's filled with people because I don't know what they might do. I have no idea what their intentions are, and it's no way somebody should live.
And Dominique, how does your experience stay with you even today?
I think for me, it's just like, I was in there for so long. Imagine going a decade of being subjected to something that you just know is not right. Imagine like knowing your whole life, the difference between what right and wrong, and everybody, and like knowing that every adult should, but like still wrong you like again and again and again and again. And like, so, like, I got to a point where, like, I actually started believing, like, I'm the crazy one. Like, maybe I'm wrong, and, like, maybe what they doing is right.
You know, I'm going to ask all of you this. We have a lot of problems in our state, and people may listen to us talk in this conversation. And I have to ask, why should people care about what happens to someone who commits a crime and goes to prison, where someone might say, well, you know, I'm sorry that happened, but don't commit crimes and wind up in prison? What do you say to that?
I'd like everybody to understand, I was young, I was stupid, I've made mistakes. Today I work hard, but I don't feel like I should have been sentenced to extra. I shouldn't have been sentenced to what I've been through. I get angry. None of us deserve it. None of us here. None of the youth do. I don't care what their crimes were. It doesn't matter. A child's a child. You figure out ways, you take them to therapy, you figure out the true issues that are going on with this person. You don't throw them with mass incarceration.
Dominique, you want to add anything?
The way I look at it is like this, right? It's like, imagine somebody treating a kid like an animal for 10 years and then letting that person out. So now we see, like, why our recidivism rate is so high. Because in all actuality, like, I've been in there. So I can be the one to say, like, I've been treated like an animal. And I've witnessed, like, other inmates being treated like animals. And so if you treat us like an animal, then we get out and act like that. But the problem is this, like, if you also look at the numbers, like, you see how many people actually get out. And so if 90% that's in prison get out of prison, then, like, they will be in the community. And if they'll be in the community, then, like, it won't do nothing but turn the community right back into garbage if, like, those people, instead of, like, being warehoused, are actually being rehabilitated.
Deb, what you say, trial January 2020. Do you expect the state to be there? Do you expect the state to, is there any more avenue to fight? You say you've never seen the state fight anything like this.
You know, I don't know. You know, when one side only wants to get before a jury and tell their story, and the other side is doing everything they can to prevent that, I think that there's an understanding that one side is not afraid of a jury. We're not afraid of this, and we'd like the public. We don't think that juries would believe that, you know, youth, both of these guys pled guilty to, you know, said, I accept responsibility. But then to take them inside and to not work at corrections or rehabilitation, but under the guise of the state, to hurt them more and deeply in a way that we don't allow. We do not allow officers to rape people. We don't allow them to watch while other adults come in and rape and harm. We don't put people in cages, children in cages. This is not who we are. And so I think that the power of this is to engage juries to say, no, you harmed them, and you will take responsibility for them, and hopefully through this process you won't keep doing it.
Dominique, Elvire, and Deb LaBelle, lead attorney in this suit. Thanks to all of you for being with us and sharing this on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We reached out to State Attorney General Dana Nessel's office, as well as the Michigan Department of Corrections for comment. They declined, citing the ongoing litigation. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.